So we're talking about Jewish legal values. When you think about the word legal versus the word values, what's the difference between laws, legal, and values? What would you say? Again, remind me of your name.
Yoni or John.
Yoni. Yes.
Legals are determined by law, and values are determined by morality.
Good. So we would think sort of, when we think of legal, we think of law. When we think of values, we think of morality. In other words, the source is different. We'd say that, you know, legal matters, laws, come from a lawgiver. In the United States, it's from Congress, or an executive order from the president. Value, that comes from morality. Maybe that's something more personal, not necessarily a law. What else comes to mind when we try to think of a distinction between laws and values, between legal versus values? Please, yeah. Remind me again of your name.
Sorry, Danny.
Danny, yeah.
I mean, you can argue based on the question you gave, but I mean, laws are binding, whereas values are not necessarily binding.
Okay, so law is binding. When you talk about the term values, it would be more subjective. It's personal, right? When we talk about values, so we usually, view values as some, almost like a personal preference. This person has this, value that's important to him. Somebody else has a different value that's important to them. That's also true. What other differences can we think of between legal and values, or laws versus values? Any suggestions?
Can you see all? I don't know if you said as many values as a preference.
Well, we said it's subjective. It's subjective. It's up to the person.
Yeah.
Well, law is much more defined. Law tells you what to do, what you can't do. Values are broad. Values are, large, overwhelming mandates, aspirations. And so when we talk of legal and values, there is room, to think that these are two different spheres. There is the matter of law, what to do, obligations, things that we have to do. And then there are values, these broad ethical aspirations, hard to figure out how to apply them, in what way to apply them, somewhat subjective, coming from a different place, not necessarily guiding you what to do, but it's more of a place of morality, a place of ethics. And when we apply that to mitzvos, to our legal system, that we have obligations that God has given to us, there could be a case made that there shouldn't be any discussion of values in regards to mitzvos. There should only be a discussion of law, of legal obligation. For example, David HaMelech, King David, Tehillim says, Kol mitzvascha emuna. All of your commandments are faith. Kol mitzvascha emuna. Or we have the Gemara, the Masechet Makos, where the Gemara discusses different figures of Jewish history who tried to summarize Judaism down into less than 613. The Gemara says, Bar David, Ben Midah Mal Yud Aleph. David said there are really 11 principles. Yeshayahu said there are 6. Finally, Bar Habakkuk, Ben Midah Mal Achas. Habakkuk came and said there's really only one principle. Tzadik Ben Munaso Yichya. Tzadik will live with his faith. In other words, we say, Kol mitzvascha emuna, all your mitzvos are faith. Or the tzaddik lives on emuna, lives on faith. What are we basically saying? There's really no room for values. What there is law. There's law. We have faith in God. God made us. We are His creations. He can tell us what to do. He told us what to do. We have to follow His words. That's it. You know, there was a professor in Israel, Professor Yeshayahu Leibowitz, Isaiah Leibowitz. He was a very ornery type of guy. He was a brilliant man. He had 10 doctorates, chemistry, biology, history, all sorts of political science, all sorts of things. And he was a very critical guy. So he said, as far as I'm concerned, I don't have Ikari Amuna. I don't have principles of faith. All I have, he said, is the Shulchan Aruch. What he meant to say by that is, I have one basic idea. God is real. God has commanded us what to do. And here, the code of Jewish law is what I'm supposed to do. Now, what does it mean? What does it represent? What values does it, you know, inculcate within me? Doesn't matter. It's the Shulchan Aruch. Code of Jewish law. God can tell me to do whatever He wants. I don't have to understand it. It's God. I have faith, and that's it. It begins with faith, and it ends with faith. There's nothing else to talk about. God told me to do it. You know, or sort of a radical expression of this would be, you know, what should somebody be thinking when he's blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah? Should a person be thinking like Rav Sadia Gaon, I'm blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah because Rosh Hashanah is the day of the beginning of the creation of the world, and remembering how Hashem blew into Adam a breath of life, or am I blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah because I'm heralding the king, it's the day of the Melucha, when Hashem becomes king? I'm blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah because Hashem told me to blow shofar. I'm blowing shofar because Hashem told me to blow shofar. I don't need anything else. There are no values, there's just laws. I don't need values. I have laws. Hashem told me what to do. And that's it. And maybe one can even make a case that there is a danger in trying to explore values in the context of laws, especially in the context of divine law. What would the danger be in trying to explore or ascribe values to divine law? What are some of the clear pitfalls that could arise? Yeah, well, again, remind me of your name.
Gav.
What's it?
Gav.
Gav.
So if you don't find value in one of the laws, then you just won't end up doing it.
Exactly. As Gav says, if a person is going to see law within the prism of certain values, what happens when there is a law that someone doesn't find meaningful? Doesn't find value in it, he might just drop it. And that's what we have in the Gemara. The Gemara tells us a very famous story. The Torah says, we read in last week's Parsha, that the Jewish people have a mitzvah to appoint a king. Som tasim alecha melech, mekere bachecha tasim alecha melech, lo tuchal asim alecha ish nachri asher lo achicha hu. And then the Torah has all sorts of laws about this king. Lo yar belo nashim, you can't have too many women. Lo yar belo susim, you can't have too many horses. So that he not make the people go back to Egypt, leman har bo sus, in order to accumulate horses. And Hashem said, don't go back to Egypt ever again. And the Torah gives a reason for this. The Torah says he shouldn't have too many wives, so that his wives not turn his heart away from Hashem. So the Gemara says, Shlomo HaMelech read these verses. He said, the Torah says, I can't have too many wives because the wives might lead me away from Hashem. But I know that I'm not going to be led away from Hashem. So what did Shlomo HaMelech do? He married too many wives. As we know, King Shlomo married 1,000 wives. So the Yud, the Gemara says, it's like a very powerful imagery. The Yud of Yarbeh flew up to Hashem and said, Hashem, if a Sefer Torah is missing this letter, missing the Yud, is it kosher? Hashem said, no, it's pasul. Well, how come Shlomo HaMelech, he's left out the Yud? He has a lot of wives. Hashem said, he's going to lose out. I said, don't have too many wives, because if one does have too many wives, the wives might lead the heart of the king away from Hashem. He has too many wives. And in fact, they did lead the heart of Shlomo away from Hashem. And as the Navi tells us, ultimately, Shlomo HaMelech ends up, you know, not protesting, that's the nicest way we can put it, not protesting the idol worship of his wives, and to some degree he was guilty with the sin of idol worship because he made the same mistake that God said could happen. If we ascribe values to mitzvos, if we see mitzvos through the prism of certain values, if we don't have those values, we don't think those values apply to us, we might not fulfill a mitzvah. And who's man to think that he knows better than Hashem? A man who doesn't fulfill mitzvos obviously is doing a terrible thing. We're doing a terrible thing if we're not listening to the commandments that Hashem gave us. You know, another basic, what else can we say? What other further reasons why we should almost say there shouldn't be any exploration of values within the context of talking about Jewish law, talking about halacha? You know, we said number one, if a person ascribes values, he might drop certain laws. What else?
I mean, if you, because the reason why values are so important, it might enhance the law itself. For example, if you do Shabbos, you know, why do I have to wait 25 hours? You'd be like, well, it's good for the family, it's good for this, it's good building dynamics, etc. You'd be like, oh, okay, we'll see less of a law and more a joyous occasion. Really, you know?
Beautiful. So that could be, you know, the other side. That would be why we should explore values, right? But in terms of understanding why we should not explore, or why we would say better not to, perhaps, why, you know, what's the position of Leibowitz, Yishayahu Leibowitz, who says, you know, I don't want to hear about reasons for mitzvos. There's only one reason. It's emunah. It's faith in Hashem. I believe in God, and God can tell me to do whatever he wants me to do. And so, you know, as far as Leibowitz is concerned, you know, whatever it says in the code of Jewish law is, you know, of the highest value. It's the most meaningful mitzvah because it comes from God. Anything that comes from God is great. You know, that's what I should do. Why? Who am I to understand? You know, another reason really to reject the whole doctrine or the whole concept of looking at legal values, not just looking at legal laws, but looking at the values behind the laws, would be that a human being, by definition, is very limited on so many levels, right? How long does a human being live? 100 years, 102 years, right? Rabbi Yashiv unfortunately passed away this last year. He was 102 years old. He married in a very long life. But how long does a person live for? In the span of time relative to history, it's rather meaningless. Certainly relative to God, who's created a universe which is, you know, huge. What is a human lifespan? Nothing. I think about the size of the universe. Current estimates of its observed diameter are, I think, 30 billion light years. In other words, light travels at 300,000 miles per second. Takes us, I mean, Israel's about 6,000 miles away, right? So I think about to go back and forth to Israel 50 times in 1 second. That's how fast, how much distance light travels. It takes light all of 8 minutes to get from the sun to Earth. And now imagine how long it would take light to travel for a year. Not just one such year. You know, the amount of space that light would cover in 1,000 years, when light covers from here to Israel 50 times in 1 second. And then when you think about light, billions of light years, and God creates all of it, controls all of it, runs all of it, is watching all of it, knows every little detail. With this massive expanse, he knows the details of, you know, how I woke up in the morning and how I went to sleep last night and how many minutes I spent doing his will or not doing his will, and when I spoke ill of others. He knows every detail, of not just of me, of every human being. So that's God. Whereas me, a simple mortal human being, how much do I know? How long do I live? What are my capabilities? For me to come and try to say, well, I'm going to understand something about his reasons, it's almost a preposterous thought. How could I begin to comprehend anything about him? In the Kabbalah, in describing God, the phrase that's used is Leis machshava tfisa beklal, which means no thought can grasp in him at all. Relative to him, I'm a human being. I'm a frail human being. What can I understand? What can I know? So maybe there's no room for Jewish legal values. Jewish legal values. There can be legal values in terms of United States law. United States is, the law was made by people like me, whatever their names may have been. Adams, Washington, Jefferson. Now it's Reed and Ryan and the whole chevra that are down in Washington. They're human beings. Probably a lot of us can think just as well, if not better, than a lot of the people down there. So we can understand their laws. We can understand the values underlying their laws. We can understand it. When we get to Hashem, the laws of the Torah, Torah law is not from a human being. Torah law is dictated by Hashem. It comes from the mind which is infinite. It comes from a mind which is so much greater than us. And therefore, a mind which is so much greater than us, how can we even begin to understand anything? No thought can even grasp anything about him. So how could we grasp an understanding of the values behind his laws? And perhaps the third level of why we shouldn't be trying to grasp values underlying laws is because of the danger, similar to what Goff said before, but the danger that we've seen in our history of when man makes himself into God. It's a terrible danger when man legislates his own morality. When man can decide for himself what is right and what is wrong. Give you just a very practical example of the danger of man deciding for himself what is right and what is wrong. There is a movement of euthanasia which holds that a person's life is only worth something if he's enjoying life. And if somebody is terminally ill or very, 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 very pained, cancer all over his body, or AIDS all over his body, very short lifespan to live, there's a movement that says, put people out of their misery. We'll give them some morphine or some poison, and they'll die. Now what is this? In essence, this is a human being legislating morality. God said, lo tirtzach. God said, don't kill. God didn't say in the Bible, you're allowed to kill if you really, really feel bad and he's willing to get killed. God said, lo tirtzach, don't kill. The movement of euthanasia is, well, it's so painful for me to see my grandfather or my father or my wife or my child suffering like this. So I'm going to take their life. In fact, I don't know if you saw, just last week, it was a guy who shot his wife. Did you see it? I think it was out in St. Louis, actually.
Really?
I think so. There was a guy, an older guy, who walked into the hospital. His wife was this really, the foundation of the whole family. And she had gotten really sick, and the doctors didn't have a lot of hope. And she was, in a really bad spot, in the ICU, out of the ICU. He came back to the hospital with a gun, put it to her temple, and they killed her. Shot her. So it starts as euthanasia, which is somewhat, it's almost like, it's not so bad. It doesn't look like killing because, it's with a tube and an IV and it's a doctor. Becomes a guy shooting his wife. And the Nazis, as we know, they began with euthanasia. And they then took euthanasia to be killing also the handicapped, and then killing the Jews, and then killing the Slavs, and the homosexuals, and anyone, and the gypsies, and anyone who wasn't like them. So there's a terrible slippery slope of a human being trying to legislate morality, which that if a human being thinks that he got it, oh my gosh, horror of horrors, what could come. The worst evils can be whitewashed with a false veneer. Oh, it's moral. It's fine. It's okay. This goes back, as Rav Soloveitchik writes in Halachic Mind, this goes back to the very first sin. The very first sin of Adam. When Adam fell, and Adam was devastated. We have very little recollection of what Adam was before the sin. But Adam before the sin was an unbelievable creation. Gemara says in Maseches Chagiga that Adam before the sin could see from one end of the world to the other. Adam before the sin was a very high heavenly being, an unbelievable being. You know, Gemara says that his heel, Akevo, Mechahe Gal Gal Chama, his heel would shine with such a shine, it would dim the light of the sun. What the Gemara means to say is that Adam before the sin was godly. Adam before the sin, as the Maharal writes, Adam is from the term Adamelo Elyon, I resemble the one above. Adam before the sin was reflective of great, great holiness. The angels were worried about Adam. He was greater than the angels. And Adam today, us mere mortals, we're not dimming the light of the sun. The angels aren't worried about us. We're not, you know, when you meet a human being, you're not saying, whoa, what a godly being. The animals aren't worried about us. What happened? It all happened because of the sin of eating from the tree of knowledge. The tree of knowledge wasn't just a sin. As the Rambam writes in Morna Buchin, eating from the tree of knowledge transformed Adam. Just like everything else in the 6 days of creations, everything in the 6 days of creation, you know, created a lasting definition of things. The creation of Adam and Adam eating from the tree made a different Adam. It lowered Adam. It reduced Adam. It became a whole different person because he ate from the tree. And what led Adam to eat from the tree? What words does the Torah use? The snake said to Chava, "V'hiyiten ke'elohim yod'ei tov v'ra. You will be, as God, knowers of good and evil. You will be God who can decide for yourself what is good and what is evil." And so, because Chava thought she could decide for herself what is good and what is evil, she decided it's okay to eat from the tree. And that really goes to a deeper level of what God said. God said, if we look at values, reasons for mitzvos, reasons for commandments, then we are in danger. And the danger is that certain reasons won't resonate with us. We may not fulfill them, like Shlomo HaMelech said, well, the Torah says the king shouldn't have too many wives because then the king will end up his heart straying from Hashem. But I know I'm so loyal to Hashem, I won't stray. And look, Shlomo did stray. And even worse, if a person thinks that he can give reasons, a human being thinks he can give reasons to the infinite God, he reduces God into being him, then the human being might try to play God. And that is horrifying. When a human being tries to legislate morality to decide for himself what is right, what is wrong, what a horrific, horrific display can emerge. Nazism, in essence, is from subjective morality, where human beings choose for themselves what is moral and what isn't moral. Morality has to be not subjective, but objective, absolute, divine. It's from God. We have to listen to it. And maybe reasoning and giving reasons and giving values is a danger to the autonomy, independence, to the eternity of a moral code. Rav Soloveitchik, one very famous drasha, pointed out that we all know the famous Rashi at Korach. He rebelled against Moshe, and that section of the Torah is right after the section of Tzitzis. What's the connection between Tzitzis and Korach's rebellion? So Rashi says that Korach had just heard that there is a mitzvah to have how many strings of tchelet, how many strings of dyed blue on Tzitzis? One string dyed blue. So what did Korach do? He showed up with a talis, shakula tcheles, with a garment. The entire garment was dyed with that special blue dye. And we have to realize that the blue dye of tcheles was extraordinarily expensive. Very, very expensive. For example, the Gemara says, I think it's in the Seches Megillah, that Zebulun was very jealous of Naphtali. Naphtali was given a portion in the land of Israel that was extremely fertile, had a tremendous amount of wheat. And Zebulun was given the coast. So Zebulun said, what do I have? I have a coast. I can't grow anything here. So Hashem said, no, don't worry, Zebulun. Because you have the coast, you have what's in the waters of the coast. You have the chilazon. And the chilazon, which is this sea creature that would produce the tcheles, was extremely rare. The Gemara says in Menachos, it would only show up once every 70 years. And everyone needs chilazon, because everyone needs to dye their strings tcheles on their tzitzis. So you're going to make a tremendous amount of money. You have, you know, you have a natural resource, which is extremely rare, and there is a tremendous pent-up demand. Supply is very, very limited, and no one can go anywhere else. So Zebulun said, I'm worried they're going to use imitation. Hashem said, I curse anyone who uses kala ilan. Anyone who uses the dye made out of a plant gets cursed. No way. You only have a blessing if you use the treles that comes from the sea creature, the chilazon. So Zebulun was satisfied. Okay, he has the chilazon, he was satisfied. It was an extremely expensive item. That's one of the theories of why we don't have treles. We're not sure if we're treles nowadays. Because it was so expensive, people couldn't afford it. After we lost the second base Hamikdash, and with such persecutions under the Romans and then the Byzantines, we lost access to the wealth to be able to afford the treles. Treles was very, very expensive. Here Hashem says, one string, you die with this very, very expensive dye. So Korach, who was one of the three wealthiest people who ever lived, the Gemara says, Korach, he shows up with a whole garment dyed tcheles. The whole garment is dyed tcheles. Not just one string, the whole thing. But the strings weren't dyed tcheles. No strings. So he goes over to Moshe Rabbeinu, he says, Moshe Rabbeinu, here I'm wearing a garment of tcheles, the whole talus. The whole thing. The whole body is covered with tcheles. Do I have to apply a couple of strings, one of those strings being tcheles on the edges? So Moshe Rabbeinu said, yes. So it makes no sense. First, it makes no sense. If Hashem wants me to show His loyalty to Him, spend money and dye one string, look how much I've spent. I've dyed the whole garment. If this string of tcheles is a reminder of the heavens and Hashem, it's blue, and remind me to think of Hashem, the whole garment is blue. Of course I'm going to think of Hashem. This Hashem made laws that don't make any sense. I'm not listening to anything. You're not from Hashem. You're a liar. I don't believe that Hashem gave the Torah. I'm making up my own set of laws. Rabbi Soloveitchik termed this the common sense rebellion against Torah. The sense of, I have this sort of set of thoughts, my own limited common sense. Torah doesn't seem to conform to my common sense. I'm rejecting it. That's Korach, the common sense rebellion. And that's very dangerous. Because as we just seen, if a person will enthrone his own mind to figure things out, to know things, he might try to become God, act like God, make up his own rules, make up his own religion, make up his own morality, decide for himself what is moral. Now, I just heard on the radio the other day that there was a group of women that wanted to have shirtless day. Not fair. Men can walk around shirtless. They want to have women walk around shirtless too. Make up their own morality. It's not what the Torah says. God said it's not a good thing. God said, you can't pass to be holy. There shouldn't be nakedness. People want to make up their own rules. People do make up their own rules. So if we apply reasons to mitzvos, we might be the types of people who make up our own rules. And that would be a horror. So there are several reasons why we should say, let's not have such a class. Jewish legal values. Talk about law and values. Values with law. So tell us the laws. Tell us how to keep Shabbos. Let's learn how to put on tefillin. Let's learn how to daven. Let's learn how to eat, how to sleep. Let's have laws. Values are dangerous. Values can lead us to the first sin. They can lead us to the sin of Korach. They can lead us to the religious subjectivism. And it's almost preposterous for a human being to think that me, mortal, limited, Zev Reichman, I'm going to figure out a reason of Hashem. Les machshava tfisa beklal. That's what the Mekubalim say. No thought can grasp him at all. In Kabbalah, Hashem is called Ein Sof. Ein Sof means with no end. A life with no end. But everything about us has ends. We have beginnings, we have ends. We can't grasp no end. We have no way of knowing no ends. Beyond our understanding. In other words, there are no words. What does it say in Tehillim? L'chadu miyat tehillah. You silence and praise. Because to Hashem, how are we going to say words and define and explain and comprehend? Hashem is beyond us. Beyond everything. In fact, we have a Gemara that seems to say this as well. This is a famous Gemara in the Seches Brachos. It's a Mishnah. The Mishnah says if a person gets up to daven for the Amud, to be a chazen, cantor, he starts composing his own prayers and he says, God, Al Kan Sipor Yagiu Rachamecha. The same way you had mercy on the mother bird, have mercy on us. As we know in this week's Parsha, one of the mitzvahs of the Torah is the mitzvah of Shivua HaKen. Ki kare lefanecha, ki kare katzipor lefanecha. Baderech obo yitzim. If you happen to meet a nest, and there is a mother bird above the nest, and she has her eggs or chicks in the nest, the Torah says, Shalach to shalach esha'im, send away the mother, es habanim tikachach. And then you can take the chicks, then you can take the eggs. But otherwise, if you didn't send away the mother, you don't have a right to take away the chicks or to take the eggs. That's what the Torah tells us in this week's parsha. So the person gets up to daven for the amud and he makes the following new prayer. Hashem, you have so much mercy on a mother. You don't want her to come back to her nest and not see her chicks there. That's why you commanded us to throw away the mother bird. Have mercy on us, says the Gemara, Meshatkin Oso. We silence him. Ask the Gemara why. For he's making God's attributes into mercy. The Einan Elagzeros. They are decrees. What is the Gemara saying? The Gemara is saying he's giving a reason. He's giving a reason for a law. It's a bad thing. The reason for the law is that it's a decree by God. Let's not go down the road of the danger of values. Let's just say, Hashem said to throw away the mother bird. Why? I don't know. Hashem said, that's why I do it, because Hashem told me to do it. So this is all on one side. On one side of why we shouldn't, you know, study values are the issues that we've mentioned. On the other hand, many, many, many authorities did try to understand Jewish legal laws in the context of values, the context of broad ethical principles. For example, the Rambam, or Nevuchim. As an example, the Rambam says that why did Hashem command the mitzvah of animal sacrifice, of korbanos? The Rambam very famously says, because the Jews in Egypt very excited and enamored with Egyptian forms of worship. And had Hashem not told us that we could offer sacrifices, we were so used to religious passion being expressed through cultic rites of slaughtering animals and invoking all sorts of demons that we would have gone down that road. And that's not a good road. And therefore Hashem said, "V'lo yizbuchu od la'seirim." They should not continue to offer sacrifices to the demons, to the demonic spirits. No, they should be loyal to Hashem. The reason for Karbanos is to keep us away from Avodah Zarah. We have this book, which again, everyone should pick up a copy of, Chorev. It's a tremendous book. It's a lot of insight. A philosophy of Jewish laws. By Samson Raphael Hirsch, where he both goes through the details of many of the laws, all the laws that are lemaisa, that are practical, and the philosophy underlying the laws, the reasons for the laws. We have the Torah itself giving us reasons. Doesn't the Torah say that eat a carbon Pesach to remember the time you left Egypt? Doesn't the Torah say, keep Shabbos, to remember that God made a world in 6 days and rested on the seventh? Or in the second set of luchos, keep Shabbos, to remember that God freed you from slavery? The Torah gives reasons. So to say that we shouldn't explore values or reasons, the Torah itself gives reasons. And let's now address, again, it's going to take me a while with the names, but was it Daniel? What Gabe said that if there's a very important reason. What was the name again?
Yoni.
I'm going to forget many, many times. Eventually, Bezrat Hashem. Why should we look at values? What would be, you know, case to build why we should look at values within the context of Torah? What did you say?
It's just the outcome. It's the derivatives of doing it. So if you don't necessarily believe in the concept of Shabbos, you can just look at it from a joyous occasion perspective, where the family's coming together, you guys talk about life, whatever.
Right, but I would challenge you on that. How strong a commitment is that going to be? Somebody is, you know, somebody says, listen, I don't know about faith, I don't know about the Torah, but I like having time with my family. Yeah. It's a good thing. Well, let's say he has a very, very horrible boss who says, if you don't stay late Friday night, I'm firing you. And if he gets fired, his family is out of a house because he can't make the mortgage payments. What's he going to do then?
Well, first of all, faith is... religion is the selfless struggle. It's essential to find footing in it.
What's that?
Religion is a struggle. It's essential to find footing in it. So you have to... So if you can't make it 1 week... For example, if you take, let's say, a Baal Teshuva, you can't make it 1 week, you'll come the next week. Because, number one, he doesn't know any better. Number two, he's going to try harder if he's interested. So, you know, maybe not this week, but maybe the next week. And, you know, then he himself will determine what, if he actually wants to take a full commitment towards
it. I challenge you, if somebody is saying, you know, I'm going to see what I like and what I don't like, how is that going to last under moments of pressure?
Well, he needs to have more exposure to it.
But if he's only doing it because he likes it, he likes family time. So when there's a lot of pressure, is he still going to do it?
Well, he can still do
it. If he's doing it for his family, right? The ultimate value here is his family. Well, can he make a very strong case? I keep Shabbos, this horrible loss. My family's going to be out on the street. I need to take care of my family. I care about my family.
So you're going to say to me, well, he has to pick and choose what he wants to do, or he's going to drop it all together.
What I'm asking is it possible to have a strong commitment without, you know, having that first part of tremendous faith?
I mean, he can be a faithful religious person, but he won't fall into the category necessarily of Orthodox or Reform or Conservative. He'll be religious to an extent.
But how strongly religious will he be? Will he truly be religious? Will he truly be even ethical? Because if someone is willing to drop what he says, something very valuable, he's willing to drop it because of weight pressure, would he truly be ethical? Because doesn't ethics require that a person have great courage and conviction in situations of pressure? I'll give you an example.
But there's a process.
I'll give you a story. There was a very, very great Lubavitcher Rebbe, the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, not Rebbe Menachem El Shmirsky, Rebbe Yosef Yitzchak Shmirsky. And in 1917, the communists took over Russia. Thankfully, it's already now distant memory, but it was a time of horrific pain for observant Jews. The communists hated religion generally, hated Jewish religion particularly, and killed people for the crime of davening from a siddur putting on tefillin, trying to keep Shabbos. Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Shneerson stayed in Russia under the communists, and he was not going to bend. He had his shluchim, his various Chabad followers, private schools, teaching people Torah, even though it was under danger of life, loss of life. Teach people Torah, teach people Yirat Shamayim. It's a very famous story where Yosef Yitzchak Shneerson was arrested by the Soviet secret police called the NKVD. And actually, the person interrogating him was his nephew. His nephew had become a communist. And his nephew said to him, "Tell me who you have and where they are. Tell me who is out there teaching Torah illegally." Rabbi Shneerson said, "I'm not going to tell you." And the nephew took out a gun. In the story, he said in Yiddish, "I have in my hand a kleina chachkala," which means I have a little toy. And he rolled it around. It's made a lot of people talk. "Tell me who you have and where they are." The Rebbe looked him right in the eye, without flinching. The Rebbe said, "Some people believe in one world and in many gods. And when they see that gun, they sacrifice some for others, and they would talk. I believe in one God, but in many worlds. You can shoot." Put the gun down. Eventually, because of tremendous pressure in America and other places, the Rebbe was released. He eventually came to America. What's Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Shneerson saying? He's done something very, very deep. He's saying, because he believes in God, God being the only absolute source of morality, ethics, following God's law, and that there are many worlds. Soul is in a body now, but after it's finished in the body, it goes to another world, and another world. So listen, I'm not going to go against God. It's a law in the Torah that a Jew is not allowed to give up another Jew to cause them to die. Yehareg v'al yavar. I need to get killed before I kill another Jew. Before I do mesira, before I hand over another Jew, I need to be willing to get killed. I'm not willing to hand over another Jew. You'll kill me? Okay. So I'll leave the body, my soul will live somewhere else. Because I believe in many worlds. He said, but you, to his heretic nephew, he said, you believe in only one world. That's it. It's just life here. There's nothing afterwards. Soul doesn't continue. There's no heaven. There's no God. You know, life is this, you know, fluke. Human life is a fluke of science, a fluke of evolution. Okay, there's a human being. He understands things more than animals, but it's just a fluke. The animal could have been this way. You believe in one world. Now, gods? You have a lot of gods. You want wealth, and you want honor, and you want pleasure, and you want family, and you want country. You have a lot of gods, a lot of values. So when you think you're going to lose everything, you're going to lose life, you'll sacrifice your friend to keep your own life. But I won't. And what's Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Shneerson telling us? For morality to be strong, it has to be rooted in an absolute commitment to God. If the moral behavior that we do is based on a preference, you know, personal reason, it's not going to be strong in crisis. It's going to collapse in crisis. You know, there's a major case to be made that in World War II, perhaps, the whole argument amongst the historians, the guy Jan Gross and Jonah Goldhagen, back and forth on this question, but there is a case to be made that in World War II, what hurt the Jews the most wasn't the Nazis. It was the bystanders. The bystanders. Those who stood by when the Nazis did what they did. The Nazis weren't so many people. Relative to Europe, one case to say, you know, most of Europeans are anti-Semites, and once the Nazis were doing what they wanted to do, they just cheered them off. That's what some think. But others think, no, it was a minority that was violent and cruel and not caring. It was a small minority that was courageous and heroic and willing to risk their lives to save others. And then there was the majority, which was, they would have let the Jews live, but they didn't have enough conviction to be able to stand up against the Nazis, to resist the pressures and the stresses. So they just stood by. And that's why it was able to happen. Had they all acted on conviction of the morality that they professed to possess, the Holocaust wouldn't have occurred. I don't know, this is a question for the historian, but the concept again and again is that in moments of stress, if my motivation for moral behavior is essentially not God, whatever it is, then in moments of stress, that motivation might give way. So let's say a person says, you know, I'm going to keep Shabbos. I don't know about God. I don't know about religion, but it's nice. It's nice to have family time. It's a nice thing. But what happens, though, when it's a real challenge? If the value is the family, what's he going to do when it might mean he loses his job if he keeps Shabbos? He still keeps Shabbos.
Well, let's say his faith gets stronger. You're assuming that his faith won't grow. You said
that. Oh, and that I can't say. Absolutely. People's faith can grow. Absolutely. What I'm arguing, though, is that...
in the worst case.
I'm arguing that the aspiration has to be that everything emerges out of deep faith in God. Because if it doesn't emerge out of deep faith in God, the morality might be very, very fragile. Maybe, yeah, as long as it's comfortable, the person does it. But once it's not comfortable, it's not going to do it. And then moral behavior is not going to happen. And moral behavior is very, very needed on many levels. Yeah, question?
So then, along the same lines, could you argue then that instead of replacing the legal value with a your own personal value, then you say that once you have a legal foundation, once you add value to legal, then to make it more personal. Because you can argue that.
Ah,
in many
I agree.
Cases.
Very good. Beautiful. Again, what's your name?
Danny.
Danny. So Danny says something very meaningful. Danny says perhaps we have to start with the foundation of faith. Exactly. Kol mitzvah sa'emuna, David HaMelech said. All mitzvahs are predicated on faith. Habakkuk ve'amidon al achas. Habakkuk came and said, "There's one basic foundation. Tzadik ve'amunaso yichyeh. Righteous lives with faith." We have to realize that our commitment to what Hashem tells us to do is an absolute commitment, because it's from the absolute and the eternal, the one and only Master of the world, the Creator of the world. He's telling us what to do. So our commitment is forever. Whatever He tells us to do, that is the right thing, without question. We have faith. But there is another issue, which is sometimes a person is only working with faith and law and legalisms. A person might be missing a degree of personal passion. You can get to a situation where somebody does what he's supposed to do, but he doesn't have any feeling in it. He does it out of routine. Anybody here in my next class? Next period? No? The next class we'll talk about this further, but religion requires passion. Morality requires passion. A passionless religion is a religion where the handwriting of its death is already on the wall. It's not from me, it's from the Nabi Yeshayahu. Nabi Yeshayahu, Perek Chavtes, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Nabi Yeshayahu says, Vatihi Yirasam Osi. It was their fear of me, says God, Kemitzvas Anashim Ulumada, like the practice of people that they are just habitual. People go through routines. Why do people just go through a routine? Because they don't have any understanding and any sense of meaning in it. Just a set of laws. Just a list of laws. A law that's just a list of laws may not be fulfilled, may be dropped. And this actually was the historical context of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. Does anyone know when Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch lived? Excellent. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch spanned almost the entire 19th century. 1808 to 1889 was the years of his life, 81 years. And he lived in Germany at a time when German Jewry underwent a massive change, which to this day we are still living with. And that was the Reform Movement. In the 18th century, the 1700s, certainly before that, the 17th century, the 16th century, the 15th century, the masses of Jewry were observant of Torah and mitzvot. It was unheard of to have someone say, I'm a Jew, but I don't always keep Shabbos. Jew kept Shabbos. Unheard of. Now, were there Jews who sometimes converted to Christianity to get away from the persecutions? Yes, there were, but it was always a very small minority. Masses of Jews overwhelmingly were observant of Torah and mitzvot. Starting with the late 18th century, but really picking up speed in the 19th century, there was a massive movement starting in Germany to be Jewish without the practice of Jewish law. The Reform Movement. Reform means to change. To reform, to change Judaism. Judaism that had traditionally been observance, now to redefine it into something else. Make it something different. The Reform Movement with leaders like Samuel Holdheim and Abraham Geiger was radical in its attempts to remake Judaism. Sometimes they would turn the Sabbath onto Sunday. Rabbis would wear cloaks of Lutheran ministers, even with the collars. They brought an organ into the temple. Stopped using the word shul, synagogue, instead called their buildings temples. They built them like the big Gothic churches, the same type of architecture. They took out the mechitza, have men and women pray together, a family that prays together stays together. Men and women should pray together. There shouldn't be a mechitza separating men and women. Change the language of prayer from Hebrew to German. Take out those prayers that seemed so quaint, archaic, old-fashioned, like the Techezena in Einu B'Shulcha L'Tzion V'Rachamim, our eyes should see your return to Zion in mercy. The Reform Movement felt what? Return to Zion. We've left Israel in the year 70. We're never going to go back to Zion. And if we would go back to Zion, then we'd be disloyal to the fatherland, to Germany. I know we have to get rid of the Techezena in Einu. And all of this was a response to modernity, to the winds of change, especially after the Napoleonic Wars, when Napoleon broke down the ghettos, claimed that he became with the fellowship of man, all of mankind being equal, civil rights, and Jews being welcomed to leave their ghettos and enter into society and get rid of all this old-fashioned discrimination against the Jews. German Jewry en masse left Jewish practice. If you want to read an unbelievably eloquent work about this, it's called The Pity of It All by Amos Eilon. It's a tremendous book. It's very, very good, very well written, where he basically goes year by year from 1745, when Mendelssohn entered Berlin. This process of German-Jewish acculturation to German society began, and he ends in 1935 when Hannah Arendt has to run away from Berlin because the Nazis say, Jude raus, Jews out, all Jews leave. Rabbi Hirsch was a courageous lion fighting for the return to Jewish practice, fighting the Reform, fighting to get Jews to be observant. One of the major critiques of the reform were there are a lot of laws, they said, that are just ceremonial, rituals. They don't mean anything. Why should we do them anymore? They said, Judaism is beautiful when it speaks about love your neighbor as yourself, help the orphan and the widow. That's beautiful. But ceremonies, keeping the Sabbath, even circumcision. The whole time was against circumcision. Circumcision, these are, who needs it? Kashrus, who needs these things? Just lists of laws. Rabbi Hirsch, who would like to bring Jews back to observance, sees that part of what's leading Jews away is that Jews don't understand the value of mitzvahs. So he writes the Chorev to say, listen, as Danny said, there is a lot of meaning that I can find here, and you can find this meaning as well. And once you find meaning and value, maybe you won't let go of it so quickly. You say, what's the point of kashrus? Ceremonial laws, what would God care whether the animal is slaughtered in this way or slaughtered in that way? Maybe there isn't an issue in kashrus. First of all, there's a very powerful ethical lesson. A person has to be able to control instincts and appetites. If I don't control my instincts and my appetites, who knows what I might do wrong because of my lower instincts? A human being has something higher than instinct, his mind. And so kashrus trains me to control my instincts. It's not non-ethical, it's very ethical. It's moral training. Shabbos teaches me I'm not the master of the world. What horror has come when people think they're the masters of the world? But I'm not the master of the world. God is the master. I have to rest on the seventh day. So there's a lot of ethics and morality within the laws. So don't drop the laws so quickly. You're proud of Jewish ethics. If you don't have Jewish law, you might not have Jewish ethics. Yeah, question?
So, sounds like the values are contingent upon the legal values, the law. So,
well, they code together.
You can't really equate the two. But they're not really, you can't weigh them the same, though.
Uh-huh.
Because if you just look at the legal aspect, you're fine. You may not know everything why you're doing something, but you're fine, technically speaking.
Right.
But if you just look at the values, then you forget about some things.
Like sometimes. Very true.
You get related to who human mishpatim.
Beautiful, right? So who can would be more the legal? And mishpatim seemingly would be more the values. It's understandable.
Without, yeah.
Very true. Very, very true.
I don't think they should be equated.
It's interesting.
It all goes back to the legal aspect.
Ah, it's very interesting is that in our literature, what is the term used to describe this, the theme of our course, which will be the legal values? What's the term used to give reasons for mitzvos? In Hebrew, what are reasons for mitzvos called? Ta'amei ha-mitzvah. Now literally, what is a ta'am? What is ta'am? It's a taste. Why is the term ta'amei ha-mitzvahs? Because we're trying to have both points that we've been discussing all morning. In other words, we need to have passion. And if we understand why we're doing something, we'll have more passion in what we do. We need to realize that God is purposeful, and since He is purposeful, His reasons are purposeful. As the Rambam says, if the laws would have no reason, it would mean that God gave us a way of life of no reason. He gave us a mind. He doesn't want us to use our mind. It doesn't make sense. It's not right. God is purposeful, and He says, Hashem b'chachma yiseid aretz, He made a world with wisdom. He wants us to use wisdom and total understanding as well. That Gemara that we quoted, Rambam says that Gemara means that it's the wrong reason in that case. That case of throwing away the mother bird is not because of rachamim. But in general, the Rambam says you should have reasons. It's part of Torah. The Torah itself gives reasons. Yet, we know that giving too much reason or putting too much stock in reason can be dangerous. If we put too much stock in reason, we might drop mitzvos, chas v'shalom. If we put too much stock in reason, we might think we can make up our own religion, heaven forbid. Too much stock in our reasons, how dare we? We're so meager. We don't get the whole thing. And so to grasp both of these concepts, our religion, this entire subject is called Ta'ame Mitzvos. Ta'ame Mitzvos means the taste of mitzvos. When you taste something, you didn't have a whole meal, you just had a taste, but it gave you more enjoyment. It's very different to, you know, to eat food that has no taste versus eating, you know, a delicious steak or a delicious strawberry shortcake. It's an enjoyment, it's a passion. A person who eats food without taste has no passion. When there's a taste, there's a passion. But a taste implies that we know there's a lot that we don't know. And we know that the reason that we ascribe may not be the whole reason. And in this way, we can have, as it were, the dialectic. We can have both concepts. The foundation is the legal foundation of emunah, faith. Out of faith, we have a foundation of law. But we add to this foundation meaning and insights and reasons, not because without reasons we wouldn't fulfill. Through the reasons we have taste, we have a passion, we have excitement. Bezrat Hashem will hopefully, as we said so correctly, we will grow. Through observance, we will grow to higher and higher levels of faith and ultimately of fulfillment. Okay, everyone should try to get a copy of Chorev. Bezrat Hashem will continue on Wednesday.